This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. World in progress.
Children from war zones suffering from trauma demand justice.
I was 11, I was thrown into a conflict I did not cause to happen, but I suffered the most. So for justice and accountability to us is very important.
Wangari Maathai, Kenya's mother of trees and Nobel Peace Prize holder, died aged 71.
We have lost a person who has made a huge contribution to this country in a way that cannot be measured. The one thing that I'll be taking from Professor Wangari Maathai is the courage of conviction.
And an inspiration for peace in times of conflict, why former UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld, who died 50 years ago, still inspires values for global leadership.
People are starting anew to look for role models, and Hammarskjöld definitely is one of those persons on the screen, especially for the integrity he stood and the loyalty to the values.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn. Millions of children are victims of armed conflicts. Many are killed, maimed, raped, and psychologically traumatized their whole lives. Many children are recruited to fight for governments and rebel groups. They are forced to commit atrocities and are often prosecuted for these crimes. A United Nations study called Children and Justice During and in the Aftermath of Armed Conflict examines how children caught in wars can seek justice for the grave violations they have suffered. It also examines the extent to which children who commit international crimes during conflict should be held accountable for these actions. A panel of experts convened at the UN headquarters in Geneva to discuss the issue, as Lisa Schlein reports.
The war in Bosnia and Herzegovina broke out in 1992. The siege of the capital, Sarajevo, lasted nearly 4 years. Almost 10,000 people were killed, including 1,500 children. The ambassador of Bosnia and Herzegovina, Emina Kitso-Isakovic, is haunted by these memories. She relives the anguish experienced by her son during this period.
When the cannon firing was starting over the city, it was really every evening. My 10-year-old son asked me whether he would have died that night. And every night I answer, no, you shall not die. I said and hugged him and held while he was falling asleep. All children from besieged Sarajevo still suffer for trauma in the form of waiting to die.
While the study says children should be permitted to seek reparations for violation of their rights, Kitso Isakovic says the children of Sarajevo have never received justice commensurate with the crimes committed against them.
When you kill a European in a car accident, you get 10 years in prison. When you kill thousands of people in Balkan, Asia, Africa, you are in prison 5-6 years, with explanation, good behavior, the age, and you're out.
Mese Kamara was a child during Sierra Leone's decade-long civil war. He lost his parents. He learned to survive and eventually became a child activist for children's rights. He is now 24 years old and studying to become an international human rights lawyer.
What I'm here to do is to represent the voices, the millions of children whose voice go unheard, who we cannot see in this small room, but they are out there suffering in conflict.
Kamara says it is most important for him and other children who lived through this brutal war to see those who created this havoc brought to justice.
I was 11, I was thrown into a conflict I did not cause to happen, but I suffered the most. So for justice and accountability to us is very important. But then it's also mostly important when our rights are given back to us. Remember, what they did was they stole our rights from us. And when he stole something from someone, it's most important that you return that thing that he stole.
Kamara regards the trials of suspected war criminals at the Special Court for Sierra Leone and the war crimes trial of former Liberian President Charles Taylor at the International Criminal Court in The Hague as very important. He says they are giving the children and young adults in Sierra Leone a sense of hope that justice will be done. While children undeniably are victims of war, the UN study notes some children also are involved in committing crimes. Bystanders in this video are celebrating the demobilization of a group of child soldiers last year by the Sudan People's Liberation Army. The United Nations estimates hundreds of thousands of children are recruited around the world every year. It reports about 10,000 child soldiers were demobilized last year. UNICEF Senior Advisor for Child Protection and Emergencies, Pernille Ironside, says children who commit crimes should be held accountable. But she adds there's a growing consensus these children should be viewed primarily as victims and not as perpetrators.
This growing consensus is that there is a need for an accountability mechanism, but that children should not be prosecuted as the primary kind of approach to seeking accountability for any violations that they may have committed, solely on the basis of their membership with a group. We need to bear in mind that their association from the beginning is actually in itself a crime.
The Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court in 1998, defines the recruitment and use of children under the age of 15 in hostilities as a war crime. Radhika Kumaraswamy, a special representative of the Secretary General for Children in Armed Conflict and lead author of the study. She says children who are abducted and forced to commit atrocities by their military commanders should not be prosecuted and judged in the same manner as adults.
We would prefer a process of what we call diversion, which is that children are diverted away from the judicial and prosecutorial system into some alternative mechanism, which can be either a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, truth-telling, restorative justice, or some kind of rehabilitation process. And what we're saying is if they have to be prosecuted, then it must be the absolutely last resort.
The study notes states increasingly are arresting and detaining children associated with armed groups on the grounds they are a threat to national security or because they have participated in hostility. It contends children held in administrative detention during armed conflict are particularly vulnerable. Few are granted access to lawyers or are given reasons why they are being detained. The study argues states should not use administrative detention for children under 15 and detention conditions should comply with international standards and judicial guarantees. And it says the United Nations should be allowed to monitor child detention centers. Lisa Schlein, Deutsche Welle Radio, Geneva.
In a few days' time, on the 2nd of October, the UN commemorates the UN Nonviolence or World Peace Day. The idea is to promote peaceful cooperation between people and peoples, the very basis the United Nations was founded upon. One person who dedicated his life to working towards a harmonious world was the second UN Secretary General, Dag Hammarskjöld, who died in a plane crash in September 1961, 50 years ago, while he was on a peace mission to Congo. Hammarskjöld is still seen as the most important UN leader and an inspiring example of global leadership. I talked to the executive head of the Dag Hammarskjöld Foundation in Sweden, Professor Henning Melber, about Hammarskjöld's legacy.
When Dag Hammarskjöld died 50 years ago, the state of the world was pretty dramatic. You had a Cold War going on, there were a lot of countries that were getting decolonized, and several conflicts going on. Do you think since Hammarskjöld's time the world has become more violent?
Well, as you said, the world was very much polarized. Then we had the East-West conflict. We had nuclear arms race at its peak, so it was certainly not an easy job then. But I believe the job hasn't become easier now, 50 years later. We have not 50-odd states in the United Nations. We have close to 200 states. The East-West polarization has shifted to a North-South divide. The world is as little governable today as it was then. But what adds to that is we do not have the ethics of global leadership which was represented by persons like Dag Hammarskjöld. It might be speculative what would happen if Dag Hammarskjöld would be with us today. I think we are on safe grounds to conclude he would never ever have stood a chance to become Secretary General of the United Nations, because it would not be in the interest of the big powers to have someone of the caliber of Hammarskjöld. That in itself speaks against the diagnosis that we are living in a better world today.
When I asked people in my environment, journalist colleagues, younger people, most of them had never heard of Dag Hammarskjöld. Do you think they should know about him?
Yes, I think they should. But more importantly, if you move in the UN environment, it's quite heartwarming to see how many of the international civil servants do know who Dag Hammarskjöld was and which values he represented. And they are in dire need of leadership that resonates with these ethics of global responsibility, and they are denied that leadership. We are living in a time where whistleblowers in the UN system are punished for blowing the whistle. Dag Hammarskjöld and his colleagues would have welcomed and encouraged whistleblowing. So we really live in a dramatically changed world half a century later. But I think we are also, again, in search for ethics and values. And especially in the younger generation, we at the Dag Hammarskjöld Foundation see that young people come, they discover Hammarskjöld, sometimes through markings, the book he left behind, they were reading, and they discover there is a meaning in duty that makes sense to them. And they are looking for those things. So I'm actually pretty optimistic that even if for bad reasons, people are starting anew to look for role models, and Hammarskjöld definitely is one of those persons on the screen.
Why do you think he was so especially inspiring? He was killed in a plane crash. You only see black and white pictures of him. But what made his personality so outstanding, almost larger than life?
Now, like many others who were denied to live life to its fullest extent, there is this tendency to idolize and to turn them into some iconographic history. But beyond that, he represented utmost integrity and loyalty to values. He did not compromise on those fundamental principles. He very often made reference to the United Nations as an organization based on the fundamental principle of solidarity. We hardly hear the word solidarity these days. And on top of it, he was a person who combined several very different approaches. He was not a politician. For him, it was politics, a love for nature, a love for art, and being deeply religious. And he combined all of that in what he did. Now, it's very difficult to find a leader in the world today who is open to all these dimensions of life.
Why do you think are our political leaders at current much more bland compared to such an outstanding character?
Maybe the first part of the 20th century provided more space for such characters to develop and flourish and be visible. Albert Einstein would be another example, who represented not only science but also philosophy and a love for peace and commitments. We hardly find any Albert Einsteins today. But even then, I think they were a pretty rare species. And for him, the United Nations had to represent the weak states, the voiceless in the world. And his office was supposed to be independent of the strong states, because he said they have already more than enough influence in the world.
Now, and of course, the strong states also opposed him very strongly, if you think of Khrushchev calling for him to step down.
Yes, and later on, the French. A cartoon which was published in 60 in the New York Times, and it showed Nikita Khrushchev and General Charles de Gaulle. And Khrushchev had something on his jacket saying, "I don't like dark." And Charles de Gaulle had something on his jacket saying, or uniform, saying, "I don't like dark either." And Hammarskjöld, in his personal letter to Bobesko, said, "I take this as a compliment."
I believe you did a bit of research in the plane crash and the circumstances of Dag Hammarskjöld being killed in that plane crash. Do you believe that this idea that maybe he was killed by people who didn't like his approach is possible?
I'm reluctant to make ultimate statements or conclusions. But what is obvious is that there are a lot of questions and no good answers. There is a lot of evidence which would suggest that it might have not been a pure accident. He stood obviously for something which was in the way of hegemonic interests. So we say then, isn't it more important to stress what he represented, what he lived and died for, instead of wasting energy on the circumstances of his death?
Hammarskjöld, I think, was a very optimistic person despite all the challenges he was facing. He said that he was optimistic about the future because there would always be enough people to fight for a decent future. What hope do you see that this is true?
Exactly as he said then, that there are enough people who are willing to commit their energy to those values Hammarskjöld already promoted. And you have these people. You have very courageous people the world over. They are the ones who induce change. Normally in our world, change doesn't come from the top. It comes from the bottom. We've witnessed it in the Arab Spring and in other social movements. And people are willing to sacrifice their lives for their values. And I think that is indeed the salt of the earth. That is the hope, that there are always enough people who are willing to change the world to the better.
That was Henning Melba, executive director of the Dag Hammarskjöld Foundation in Uppsala, Sweden, talking about the legacy of Dag Hammarskjöld. Another person who inspired many people in more recent times was Wangari Maathai from Kenya. She was the first African woman to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, and she died on Sunday, aged 71, after a long battle with cancer. Maathai founded the famous Green Belt movement in 1977 to plant trees and save the environment. A report by Lina Hoffmann, presented by Dagmar Breitenbach.
Come, let's plant trees was a favorite tune that Wangari Maathai often sang with fellow environmentalists. It was the motto that shaped her life. In 1977, Maathai founded the Green Belt Movement to prevent the deterioration of environmental and social conditions in rural Kenya. Then she planted 7 trees. But her project to put the brakes on deforestation quickly spread to other countries. The group has meanwhile planted some 40 million trees across the entire continent. Her reforestation work in Kenya won Maathai the Nobel Peace Prize in 2004. Mama Miti, as Kenyans call her, became the first African woman, the first Kenyan, and the first environmentalist to receive this honor.
We really need to protect. We need to do whatever it takes to protect the environment. Because if we do not protect our environment, we are going to literally commit our future generations to misery and death.
In Kenya, the movement expanded to embrace wider campaigns for social, economic, and political change, setting Maathai on a collision course with the government of then-President Daniel Arap Moi. The activist paid a high price for her unflagging devotion to African causes. She was repeatedly whipped, tear-gassed, and threatened by police. Maathai was born in the Central Highlands of Kenya. She earned a master's degree in the United States before becoming the first woman in Kenya to receive a doctorate for veterinary medicine and first to be appointed a professor. Maathai, who was also elected to Parliament in 2002 and appointed Assistant Minister for the Environment in 2003, constantly warned.
When you are poor, when you are underdeveloped, when you are using the resources at their primary level, depending on the land for food, depending on water in the rivers, depending on the rain, the environment is not a luxury. It is an essential part of your life, and you need to protect it.
Edward Wageni, the Green Belt Movement's deputy executive director, announced that Maathai, who had long struggled with cancer, died in a Nairobi hospital late on Sunday. She had been in and out of the clinic since the beginning of the year. As tributes poured in from all over the world on Monday, Wageni said that Kenya has lost a woman who made a great contribution to the country, a woman whose courage of conviction he greatly admired.
Once you believe in something and you believe it's for the good of the nation and the world, doing it without having to look at who is applauding you.
In recent years, Wangari Maathai founded green groups and launched several campaigns against climate change and environmental protection. She perpetually fought for a greener world. Mama Miti's heritage, the many parks and forests that would not exist but for her and her dedication. Dagmar Breitenbach, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Still to come here on World in Progress, a report about an inspiring Cuban band. But first, here's Jesse Wingard with some development news.
Thailand could send rice price soaring. Thailand, the world's biggest rice exporter, plans to boost the minimum price paid to its farmers by directly buying unmilled rice. Starting in October, farmers will receive 15,000 baht, or about 360 euros per tonne for their crops. Currently, producers are receiving about 10,000 baht per tonne. Rice is a staple food for more than 3 billion people, which is about half of the world's population. Thailand's plan, part of promises that helped propel former President Thaksin Shinawatra's allies to victory in the July election, has fueled speculation world prices are set to surge. EU subsidies continue to hurt developing nations. European subsidies continue to damage milk producers in developing nations despite reforms aimed at avoiding distortion in international trade and prices from farm products, according to a report by NGO ActionAid. ActionAid said 5 billion euros of Europe's annual subsidies had routinely damaged developing countries in three main ways: by undermining domestic dairy producers, depressing world market prices, and pushing developing country exporters out of third markets. Woman in Saudi Arabia punished for challenging driving ban. A court in Saudi Arabia has sentenced a woman to 10 lashes for challenging a ban on women driving, Amnesty International said. The sentence was reported 2 days after King Abdullah granted women the right to vote and run in municipal elections. Allowing women to vote in council elections is all well and good, but if they are still going to face being flogged for trying to exercise their right to freedom of movement, then the King's much-trumpeted reforms actually amount to very little, Philip Luther, an Amnesty Regional Deputy Director, said. Two other women are also believed to be facing charges for driving a car. Zambia's president tells Chinese investors to respect the country's labour laws. Zambia's President Sata, who was elected to office last week, warned Chinese investors to respect the country's labour laws. "Your investment should benefit Zambia and your people need to adhere to local laws," Sata told Chinese Ambassador Zhu Yu Chao, who paid a visit to the new president. Sata is known for his tough stance on the influx of Chinese investment into the country, particularly the mining sector, which he says does not benefit locals. China has invested some 4.3 billion euros into the local economy since 2007, which is more than one-third of Zambia's gross domestic product. Poorer Zambians have claimed Chinese companies are importing their own workers and mistreating the locals they do employ.
That was Jesse Wingard with the development news. And our last story today is about inspiring people in music. The Creole Choir of Cuba has been a recent hit on the international circuit with their unique combination of Cuban rhythms with tunes from Haiti, where their African ancestors were taken as slaves. The band's songs recall the struggles of the slaves and their resistance, transcending their lyrical content and any language barrier with an incredibly rhythmic and energetic vocal style. Maria Bakalapulo caught up with the group before a concert in Edinburgh, Scotland recently.
At their rented apartment in Edinburgh, Scotland, the Creole Choir of Cuba turn up the thermostat, making the place feel like a tropical paradise. They spend a minimum of 6 hours a day perfecting their vocal technique and dance moves. Many of the songs are rooted in resistance against oppression, and the music illustrates a rich texture of Caribbean and African lineage. As many as 10% of Cubans claim Haitian heritage. The choir's artistic director, Emilia Diaz Chavez, founded the group in 1994.
Históricamente han sido muy discriminados. Y nosotros que nacemos...
We feel a debt to our ancestors and our fathers, our grandfathers, everyone who came from Haiti. I mean, Haiti is still a very young country. It was only established as a country for the last 200 years. And during that time, even from its first sort of step as a country, it's been seen in a fairly bad light as a very impoverished country, possibly run sort of corruptly. And it's been given a lot of negative connotations, and we feel that our ancestors fought so much for freedom and for independence in so many ways, not only against the colonial powers, but within. And that also it's a country that has so much richness to it, and that it is a positive message. For us, it's a very proud moment to be able to give that back.
All the members are descended from African slaves, brought over to Haiti and then on to Cuba. Each member has stories of their parents and grandparents escaping Haiti during the French colonial era, or as refugees fleeing the repressive and brutal dictatorship of Baby Doc Duvalier. Song became an expression of resistance, says Emilia.
One of the songs we sing is Chennaren, which is a song that is sung by Haitian groups back in Haiti as well. And it talks of the exploitation of the slaves originally from West Africa, and the sort of pain and the difficult times that they went through, to the moment in which there's an explosion, well, in terms of the uprising of the black slaves and founding the first black republic, and that being a moment of hope. But then the song takes another turn in which it shows that this whole journey from slave to free man has not been easy, and it still hasn't quite reached total freedom or total equality. Still on that journey, getting somewhere.
Chennaren means chains around the waist. The song is a defiant cry for freedom, protesting against the exploitation and suffering of the poor. Many that came from Haiti to work on Cuban sugar and coffee plantations hope to escape the political turmoil. The popularity of the vocal group gives the members a chance to travel to reconnect with Haiti. They were also part of the relief effort in the aftermath of last year's earthquake in Haiti.
Mi nombre es Marcelo Andrés Luis.
So my name is Marcelo Andrés Luis. I'm composer, arranger, and percussionist in the choir. I sing bass. Actually, my father came from Haiti at a very young age, sort of 15, 16, with a brother of his. Although my father ended up staying in Camagüey working in the fields, where he met my mother, who's also a Haitian descendant. So that, for me, being Haitian is a very strong part of who I am. It's part of my direct heritage.
By traveling back and forth to Haiti, the group is able to develop their tremendous vocal skills. Because the group is government-sponsored, the members are able to devote themselves fully to their music. The songs are rooted in oral tradition, but the Creole Choir of Cuba is lifting the music to new technical heights. Emilia Diaz-Chavez.
Sí, pero el estilo...
Slaves back then their setup would be someone would present a theme, and much like in the plantations when they're working, someone would begin. And the rest of the people around would respond. So it's the call and response, and that's a very African tradition. And we incorporate that idea into our songs. The only difference is that we have, obviously, all a very strong musical background, and we have musical knowledge that is different, so our harmonies are worked on and they're perfected in a way that their harmonies were almost a natural harmony. They would adjust their voices in the response to whatever the call and the theme was.
The union of Cuban and Haitian music is the soul of the Creole Choir of Cuba, and their hard work in fusing the two is winning new fans wherever they go. For Deutsche Welle, I'm Maria Bakalopoulou in Edinburgh, Scotland.
And that's all we have for you today on World in Progress. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week with a new edition at the same time. In the meantime, you can find more information on today's topics and other development issues on our webpage at dwworld.de/development. For today, on behalf of the studio team, I'm Anke Rasper in Bonn saying thanks for listening and goodbye.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.